It's The Record from KUOW. In the late 1960s, a University of Washington professor and pediatrician named Robert Deischer wondered why he saw so many homeless young men on the streets in Pioneer Square. It turns out a lot of them were runaways who identify themselves as gay, and they'd been kicked out of their parents' homes. Deischer started a program to help kids and adults in the LGBTQ community. Seattle Counseling Service now helps hundreds of people every year. Anne McGettigan has served as the agency's executive director for the past 16 years. I was curious what kinds of counseling services existed before Dr. Deischer started Seattle Counseling Service.
None. I would imagine, I wasn't here at the time, but definitely there was a dearth of resource in terms of, especially for counseling that was going to help people to feel healthy and well about their identity. If you remember, 1969 was not a time of great support for gay civil rights. So if folks were in counseling, they were probably struggling mightily with their identity.
At that time, were there a lot of counselors who could help these kinds of kids? Were there people who had focused on gay and lesbian issues?
Well, no, that's an interesting question, because it definitely wasn't part of any curricula in terms of, school of psychology or school of social work. So what Dr. Deischer did was he recruited graduate students who had sort of progressive leanings, I would say, and who were interested and who may have also identified as gay, to help do kind of rap groups and peer support as part of kind of an internship opportunity.
I'm getting the impression of, one of those kind of late 60s places with beanbag pillows, and it's sort of a crash hangout.
Yeah, in fact, the first staff that worked there lived there as well. So they were upstairs in the top part of this little house on Capitol Hill, and then downstairs, like the living room, dining room, was where groups happened or counseling sessions happened.
Where was this?
It was on Capitol Hill around 14th and Malden.
Wow. So one of those old houses that are few and far between these days on Capitol Hill.
Yeah.
So it really was kind of half hangout, half place where you could get the kind of services you
right,
need.
Right, definitely. And we tell the story that it was very clandestine, though. The phone number was published, but that phone number would get you to another phone number, which got you to another phone number. So you would get sort of hopping phone booths as you got more directions about where the house was located.
Wow. So it was like a safe house. Yeah.
Definitely. Definitely.
That's interesting. Were there anti-gay repercussions against the physical building or the staff?
Well, I think people kind of, the way I would describe it, sort of operate on the down low. So Seattle Counseling Service, at that time it was Seattle Counseling Service for Homosexuals. The word was out there about it, but it was very word of mouth, and that phone number was attached. And so getting there for the first time was this process. Once you knew where it was, though, you kind of kept that confidential in order to maintain confidentiality of other folks. So definitely, Dr. Deischer, who I met with several times, told me stories about the police kind of circling the building. They knew where the location was, and so they would circle and shine lights in the windows and kind of harass folks that were inside. They never came in. They never busted the place down. But there was definitely a sense of, I think, fear out there, out in the world. So it was a big risk to take to come in.
It must have been a little worrisome in terms of people's files. I'm assuming most files were paper at that time. So how did they keep people's confidentiality?
Well, that was one of the most amazing things Dr. Deischer talked about to me, which was that, so you have to keep records when you're doing counseling sessions, and you want to keep those confidential and private. And so the way they did that was they kept them in a file cabinet, and they literally had a can of gasoline on the top of the filing cabinet, and it was ready if someone were to raid the house. Now, fortunately, that never happened, but it speaks of kind of the risk and the challenge that it would have been to even do work there or to come in for services.
Well, that's amazing. So that's
5 years ago. The year we're celebrating our 45th year. We're the first program of our kind in the country.
Tell me what your Seattle Counseling Services is like today.
Well, it's a little different.
You don't live there?
No, we're not living there, although some of us might feel like we do sometimes. No, we're much larger. We're on Capitol Hill still. We've stayed there except for one little brief blip in our history. We are on the corner of Pine and Melrose. We are in a three-story building. We occupy two of those stories. We have we see about 1,500 people a year, and we have a really robust, comprehensive licensed mental health program and licensed chemical dependency program.
And there's a sign on the
building?
There's
a sign. I was telling the story the other day. My vision when we moved to that building 11 years ago was I wanted us to have like a ginormous neon rainbow sign. And our staff were like, Anne, are you sure? That might invite trouble. And I'm like, no, we have to not. This isn't just for SCS. This is for our community. So we have this 18-foot rainbow neon sign on our building with SCS down the side. But it really is a hallmark for the community because we are, you know, Capitol Hill is still considered the heart of the LGBT community.
So you came here in 1982. What brought you from the Midwest to Seattle?
My girlfriend at the time, she was moving and she moved ahead of me 4 months. And I, of course, had to act like that's not why I was moving. But but I came out here to visit a little while before that. And I'm originally from England. And this environment is so familiar to me. I just fell in love with it right away. I just love the gray and the cloud. And so eventually I did follow her. Mm-hmm. And it was a good thing.
She's not your girlfriend anymore.
No, she is.
How old were you when you came out?
I was probably 23. Yeah.
And so ish. 70s?
Is that yes.
In the 70s?
Late 70s.
Was it hard? How was that?
Well, I'm from an Irish Catholic family.
Oh.
And so it was a bit hard. It was a surprise. I guess what I would say is I'd had relationships with men, a few relationships, a couple of significant ones, which had been fine. But I think when I fell in love with a woman for the first time, it was astounding to me. And it felt like, oh, then all of a sudden things fit together and I understood myself better. So that was an amazing, magical revelation. And I don't talk about this very often anymore because it's been such a long time. But and my English accent will come out now.
Good.
But I think, you know, it was an extraordinary experience. And then I was immediately faced with how do I begin to tell my family? I have four sisters and my mom and dad. And I did. It took me about 10 years over the course of several years to be able to tell each one of them.
Who did you tell first?
My mom.
You did?
Mm-hmm.
What was her reaction?
Well, it was amazing. I came out to her because I was having a health crisis, and which was resolved,
good,
thankfully, quite well. But it meant that if I was going into surgery and if I didn't make it or something happened, I needed her to know how important my partner was. And so I had to tell her in the midst of this health crisis. And I was so afraid, both for my own life, but also for losing love from her. So she was extraordinary. She listened to me, and then she had always worn my grandmother's wedding ring on her pinky. And so she took it off. My grandmother had passed away by then. She took it off and handed it to me. And it was one of the most moving and touching moments of my life. And it just allowed me then to go into this next challenge, feeling loved and supported and protected. So, yeah.
And nobody had a ring to give you, but same kinds of love from the rest of your family?
Eventually, yeah. My sisters each, you know, my baby sister, actually at the time, she was only, you know, 11 or 12 when I told her. And she was like, oh, I know that. I've known that. She had known it her whole life, which was amazing.
You hadn't even known it.
Yeah.
Wow.
So, and my dad was the last, and he was probably the hardest just because as an Irishman from rural Ireland, who this was all a very foreign concept to him, he was a bit puzzled by it all, but he never, ever was anything more than deeply loving towards me. Like, he didn't get it exactly, but he loved me. And eventually, my partner, most recent partner, he absolutely adored. He passed away a couple of years ago, but he eventually came to terms and was fine with it.
What keeps you passionate about this work that you do? What keeps you going when it's hard?
When it's hard. I've joked about sometimes having faith-based leadership, which is I just have faith that things will be okay even when they don't look like they will be. And so that's definitely been part of my mantra, is like, I just don't believe that things are as dire as they appear to be. So I just go do it anyway. So I've ignored a lot of, dire warnings about how this can't work or you can't do this. And I've also just, in terms of passion, we have an incredible staff and an incredible board. And really, the clients that we serve every day, even though I'm not directly working with folks, I just know that they're coming in with incredible work to do, and we're witnessing and supporting and guiding, and that makes me feel like we're helping our whole community by doing that.
So there are no cans of gasoline over files at Seattle Counseling Services?
I hope not. No, we would be having a big issue if that was. No.
Not on your watch.
No, definitely not.
Well, Anne, thank you so much for coming by. I really appreciate hearing all the stories.
Yeah, thank you, Marcy.
Anne McGettigan is Executive Director of Seattle Counseling Services. She's been the director since 1998. It's The Record. I'm Marcy Silman.